everybody, for coming out. Nice to see you all on a cold, blustery day. So I was just going to start to talk by reminding you of an interview that Donald Trump gave fairly recently in the end of January with Piers Morgan. And Piers Morgan asked him, do you identify as a feminist? Are you a feminist? And Donald Trump said, no, I wouldn't say I'm a feminist. I mean, I think that would be maybe going too far. I'm for women. I'm for men. I'm for everyone. So Trump clearly isn't a feminist, but on the other hand, clearly a lot of other people are now saying that they are. And I won't go into detail. You all know the Women's March, the Me Too movement, the International Women's Strike, and even our friend Justin Trudeau says he's a feminist. But it wasn't all that long ago that feminism was really considered a bit of a dirty word. And you might remember, some of you, you know, we quite kind of tongue-in-cheek, with our tongue in our cheek, would, you know, use the term the F word to describe feminism. It was really considered passé in many ways. But I think now it's safe to say that feminism is back, or rather, feminisms are back. There's always been a variety of distinct and crisscrossing traditions that are loosely grouped under the idea of promoting women's interests. But who those women are, what constitutes their oppression, and what feminists seek to achieve, and how, can be very, very different in people's eyes, and often kind of contradictory notions. So my piece in this pamphlet seeks to disentangle some of those different ways of defining, and therefore of doing, feminism. And specifically, I ask what a renewed socialist feminism can learn from the current moment, and what ideas and strategies it can bring to the discussion today. So before just highlighting some of those aspects, some of the key points in my article there, I just want to say a little bit about why the Toronto New Socialist wants to even encourage this discussion. So socialist feminism has, in many ways, had a bad rap, I think. It was developed out of the New Left of the 1960s and 70s, at least the recent iteration of it. Of course, it goes back much further. But what we can generally think of as socialist feminism today, really the ideas really developed out of the New Left in the 60s and 70s. It was a creative and boundary-breaking attempt to use Marxism to understand women's oppression and the relation of that to class exploitation, and in the process revise what we know of Marxism, what Marxism is. But the debates and the discussions at the time reached an impasse, both an intellectual and a political impasse, and we can discuss that later if you like, that's fine. After that, the legacy of socialist feminism, which is somewhat earned, I think, and somewhat not earned, is that it failed to grapple with the multiple forms of oppression, prioritizing explanations for and struggles of... Sorry. But is that to be or not? No, okay. It failed to grapple with some of the multiple forms of oppression. This is what the legacy of socialist feminism is, that prioritized explanation, and it prioritized explanations for struggles about gender and class over struggles around race, colonialism, queer, phobia, etc. And this is sometimes referred to as kind of the dualist legacy of socialist feminism. So much of that critique, as I say, is justified, but it discounts important insights and minority positions, I'd argue, within that tradition, which, if they were underdeveloped in the 70s and 80s, could at least, I think, point to a way past that impasse. And I'm referring here specifically to two things. One is the social reproduction analysis that came out of that period that was best articulated by Lisa Vogel in her 1983 book, Marxism and the Oppression of Women Today, Toward a Unitary Theory. And the second kind of hopeful moment still very relevant aspect of that period of socialist feminism was the movement building and activist orientation of many socialist feminists who organized in that period, organized things like sit-ins and walkouts, etc. But those elements don't get developed, and that's largely because the left as a whole retreats. It becomes academicized and demoralized. But for the last 5 years or so, for all kinds of reasons, again, which might be interesting to discuss, there's been an interest in exploring these ideas, and also there's been a greater interest, I think, in more confrontational politics, too. in the last 5 years or so. And today, it's not just feminism, but also socialism. That's no longer a dirty word. So that's one of the reasons, I think the key reason that we decided to pull together this pamphlet. So my piece in it is a kind of a very, it's a partial mapping of feminism today. And I do this by identifying what I call three faces, which I'm naming fearless girl feminism, allyship feminism, and anti-capitalist movement building feminism. Not, that's very lengthy, not very elegant way of saying it. But those, and I don't mean to imply with that that those are the only three faces of feminism by any means. And nor does everyone fall neatly into one camp or another. In fact, most people move between them and embrace aspects of it. But they do represent, I think, influential or significant approaches to ending gender oppression while raising issues that a renewed socialist feminism needs to grapple with. And I argue, which may not be surprising to people here, that all three faces are significant for having generated substantive material changes in women's lives, but it's a third approach, the anti-capitalist movement building feminism, that gets us thinking about and shows us a way to build a transformative politics that can most directly grapple with the systemic nature of oppressions. So what I'll do next is just go through those three forms briefly. So the first one is fearless girl feminism. And I just, that name I use, I don't know how many people have seen the bronze statue that was put up on Wall Street of a girl, little girl facing off against the charging bull. There's a sort of iconic charging bull statue, bronze statue on Wall Street. And so Kristen Bisbell, last year for IWD, her statue of the fearless girl was unveiled, and it was erected, in fact, or the people who paid for it were was an investment company called State Street Global Advisor, which had $2.5 million in investments, a very powerful investment firm. Anyway, it, sorry, not million, trillion, sorry, $2.5 trillion investment firm, sorry. $2.5 million, not that much. So, but the message of this fearless girl is, of course, empowerment through economic independence. So the article grapples with the contradictory nature of what that empowerment means. And because, you know, while we can and should roll our eyes at the way it's been taken up by people like Justin Trudeau or Hillary Clinton or Sheryl Sandberg, who's the author of Lean In, sort of a corporate feminist book, fearless girl feminism is nonetheless, it's a logical extension of a far more defensible strategy that countless feminists, including many, many socialist feminists, have promoted for sure over the last 50 years, many from before that, and that's the strategy of gaining equality with men at work. So I argue that buying for equality, however, is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, women are undoubtedly better off with good-paying jobs than they are without jobs, or when they're doing poorly paid and unsafe work. But at the same time, individual advancement, things like higher pay and better and decent work, as a key goal. And as we know, there's only so much room, and there's not much room, in fact, for people to really have better paying, decent jobs in capitalist economies. And this becomes really important if you look at the last 50 years of women in the workforce. Women's wages have crept up relative to men's, but they've done so primarily for the high-income earners, people who make $100,000 a year or more, which is only 3.5% of American women wage earners. So it's a very, very small minority who have really, really gained from this. Meanwhile, low-waged men and women have seen their salaries stall since 2000. So it doesn't matter how fearless we girls are and how much we lean in, these politics will not empower the vast majority of us, even if they have likely helped many gain greater independence. And that's because this form of feminism doesn't directly challenge the conditions that create and reinforce the tendency to pay women less than men in the first place. Capitalism can be pushed to accommodate some measure of equality, but it can't give up its lifeblood, which is racist, sexist practices that secure for it a pool of low-waged and no-waged labor. So the next form that I look at is what I'm calling allyship feminism, which is a very broad thing, and I've lightly over-narrowed it here, but anyway.
allyship feminism is an approach that grows out of an intersectionality feminist critique of society, which, and that's a critique of society that sees racism, homo and transphobia, ableism, settler colonialism, and capitalism, among other oppressions, as all interlinked systems that work together, but they also work separately to prop up the powerful. And the allyship feminism approach, political strategy, is all about building support for marginalized communities to define their own priorities for political change, while also making it possible to challenge wider oppressive structures. There's a really, really strong emphasis on building trust by listening and learning, that is, not by taking a leading role or piggybacking on other people's struggles, and a strong emphasis on recalibrating personal relationships. So these politics have been prevalent on university campuses, or prevalent on my university campus, certainly, especially around issues of sexual assault, where careful work, they've done, you know, feminist allies have done very careful work that's been required to support survivors and slash victims. But they've also informed some of the more militant activism of groups like Black Lives Matter and Idle No More. And I just want to qualify that by saying I think groups like Black Lives Matter and Idle No More would fall more into my third camp around it. They're fundamentally movement-building organizations which have adopted anti-capitalist stance, but within that, there's also a commitment often to allyship, and it's an interesting mix, and it's an important mix, I think, and it's one that'd be great to talk more about. Certainly, you know, so I just as an example of, you know, because of that, in fact, there's been a lot of discussion amongst Indigenous people the Indigenous movement, for example, on how to be a settler ally, right? And so this is, I'm just going to quote from an article by Stephanie Pinch on Ravel that sort of gives you a sense of how you would be a settler ally. That is, you begin by educating yourself on settler colonialism. That's very good, but it's not going to be enough. And then she writes, settlers need to be active without piggybacking on direct actions, looking for token Indigenous involvement, or laying claims to struggles that aren't their own. Instead, settlers can be effective allies by decolonizing their own organizing frameworks. This involves moving beyond solidarity to reimagining relationships. So an ally is someone who identifies and takes responsibility for the complicity with oppression. And that does mean very different things in different contexts. And some I think I would agree with more than others. But there's a significant strand of allyship politics that takes this to mean that the key challenge for activists is to unpack individual privilege. So checking one's privilege, according to the Anti-Oppression Network website, organized by activists, allyship is an active, consistent, and arduous practice of unlearning and re-evaluating in which a person in a position of privilege and power seeks to operate in solidarity with the marginalized group. So I have some real criticisms of this approach generally, but I want to preface that with what I think are super positive impulses in that approach. One, there's a very serious attempt to work through the multiply layered nature of oppression and a respect for a form of self-determination of and leadership coming from people whose voices the left has sometimes and actually often silenced. And second, there's absolutely no doubt that feminist allies and other allies have helped secure real and meaningful change in very important ways. So washrooms that trans people feel comfortable entering, better lighting on city streets, spaces on campuses where racialized queer people and women can feel welcome and safe, commitment in university programs to at least teach students about settler colonialism. I've seen, you know, much of all of that happen even on my campus. So. But the trouble is, there's been very little interest in many of these quarters in moving beyond securing improvements to truly challenging the systemic nature or power imbalances that make these things necessary in the first place. So instead, the power imbalance that gets addressed is an interpersonal one. There's a focus on changing the individual behavior and attitudes, and it can kind of shade into a moralism. And ironically, and the critics have pointed out that this is a way of making feminism, once again, all about the white privileged woman. It's all about whether I, you know, my journey. So the the instinct for this, I think, is a good one. It comes from the notion that the personal is political, and I'd be interested to hear how people kind of interpret that, if people want to talk about that later. But it fails, I think, to see that personal and political power are not, can't be just simply equated. They're not the same thing. As a white, cisgendered woman, I have a ton of advantages that my Indigenous sisters don't, and I do need to be aware of those and how they play out organizationally and politically. But, and I think this is really key and something that gets lost often, we are both unevenly and to different degrees caught up in a very inhumane system, one that only cares about people's lives so long as a few, mostly white, mostly male, people, the 1%, are making profits. That's a system that thrives not just on exploiting our paid labor, but on managing our unpaid labor to keep workers available at as low cost as possible. And that's an insight, I think, that social reproduction feminism brings to understanding the systemic nature of capitalism. And it uses racism, sexism, and social oppression to that end. So that is the question of whether or not we can build trust, then, isn't just a question of interpersonal relations. It's a question of our relationship to a system that needs us not to trust each other so that we can continue to accept conditions of unfreedom that we're in. The key point here, I think, is that we need to recognize personal power relations between us and figure out what that means for our organizing, but we shouldn't equate these with wider social, societal, structural power relations that nurture and sustain them. And if we're to truly challenge that systemic power, we don't need to move beyond the personal so much as I think we need to move constantly between careful, conscious engagement at the individual level and seeing the struggle against the wider forces of power. We need to find ways to build solidarity, that is, the notion that we're all in the struggle together, which is distinct from those allies, and it's not all allies, but those allies who see their work as being one of finding ways for the more privileged among us to learn from and support the less privileged. End goal. So I don't think it's surprising at all that feminists with radical critiques of society, because intersectionality feminism is a radical critique of society, that it's not surprising that they end up with such an individualistic politics that can so easily shade into moralism. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the left as a whole hasn't been able to sustain a transformative vision of what else is possible. And so it starts to make sense to change the things that we can, our personal attitudes and our beliefs, if there's no other hope, and we might as well focus on ourselves. But there are some feminists, of course, who have done a better job of breaking out of that intense focus on personal relations that allyship feminist veers towards. And I would include in that people, absolutely, Black Lives Matter, Idle No More, Fight for 15 and Fairness. And it's because they're more open to naming and confronting capitalism. Instead, they prioritize anti-capitalist movement building, that is, the drawing together of feminists, anti-racists, queers, trans people, and others to actively claim rather than ask for improved conditions. They draw on resources that we all have, our bodies and the places where we gather, the streets, the parks, the workplaces, to protest and directly confront those who represent capitalist power, state, businesses, big institutions. And again, Fight for 15 and Fairness is a really good example of that very recently in Toronto with the Tim Hortons struggle. It's important because they raise the hope and possibility of moving beyond the limits of other approaches. And the clearest picture of how that is possible, I think, and I think this is where socialist feminism comes in particular, is from those who are renewing socialist feminist politics. And I would say the folks behind the International Women's Strike have really articulated that really well, and I'm hoping Tiffy will be speaking to that. So I'll leave that for Tiffy to talk more about. But we'll briefly discuss here now, just to finish off, how a renewed socialist feminism can engage with the politics I've been describing. And I think there's really two key things that we can both learn from and then also contribute. So I think first, in terms of learning, that we need to develop ideas and organizations that capture the multiply layered, contradictory nature of surviving in a capitalist system, and then build our solidarity from there. And absolutely, this requires the conscious, careful building of trusting relationships. But I think we can also contribute ideas around how that trust can come not just or even mainly from checking privilege, as that's understood, but from showing up and standing together, having one another's backs when we're confronting authorities. And in fact, you know, I think we can add to that too, or argue as well, that not showing up at other people's struggles can destroy trust, despite how we may personally have changed our behaviors. So it doesn't matter how much we change our personal behaviors, if they're not there for them politically, then we can destroy trust too. And then the second thing that I think we can learn is that political struggle often begins with feeling that what we do is making a difference in some people's lives in a more immediate way. Better wages, trans-friendly bathrooms, survivor-led redress for sexual assault are all super important to making life more bearable under capitalism. But I think, again, we need to add to that that if the difference is going to be felt mostly on an individual level, then we're going to still be fighting that fight 50 years from now. To move beyond making change at an individual level, we need a vision of a better and new, better system, and a convincing politics to help us get there. And I do think the social reproduction theory, and the Tithi's got two articles in this piece. The first one is on, or sorry, in the pamphlet, the first one is kind of an elaboration of what is social reproduction theory, and the second one is her discussion of the Me Too movement. And so, you know, I encourage you to read that, but I'll just very briefly give you my summary of social reproduction theory, which is an analysis of capitalism as a system of social oppression, a system that does not, in fact, equalize all workers, but rather differently degrades and dehumanizes us. And I think that can, if we take that seriously and build on those ideas, we can offer a way of renewing a socialist feminism so that we can find a language and politics of a shared struggle in which we reclaim not just our workplaces, but our communities too.
Thanking the Toronto New Socialists for this event and for the book. And I think this is a very, very key moment in both socialist and feminist mobilization. So I want to thank the Toronto comrades for bringing us all together to discuss both theory and practice of what socialist feminist would what kind of a socialist feminist shape we want to see the future mobilizations globally take shape. And since we're talking about privilege, it's always a privilege to follow Sue Ferguson in talking about social reproduction theory and socialist feminism. I want to start because Sue talked about solidarity and privilege and the sort of challenges and shortcomings of sort of calling out and checking privilege. Last year, around this time, actually, when I was last in Toronto with you, comrades, I went from Toronto to New York to speak at the Left Forum. And one of my panelists was a fantastic comrade from coming straight from Standing Rock, actually. She was one of the leaders of the Standing Rock movement. And her speech was so amazing because she started by saying, the Native people of this country, which is America, have had to learn in a very difficult way who our friends and who our enemies are. And sometimes our enemies come in friend shape and friends come in the shape of enemies. But as an Indigenous community fighting for our rights for hundreds of years, we have learned to recognize friends and enemies very clearly. So when our struggle began at Standing Rock, when we started to fight the state and the army, essentially, the first people to come out and stand with us were actually drillers and loggers. And these were white men who knew the area and knew the kind of dangers that the pipeline would bring to the area. So they were the first to come out and stand with us. The second wave was young students of you know, mixed race group of students, white and black and Latino, who came down to Standing Rock to stand with us. So what she was expressing was the material reality of how that struggle took shape. But what we, I think, have missed as a left is to draw, or what we've missed is to draw the right political and organizational conclusions from those material struggles, which have actually existed always throughout the neoliberal period, but the politics of it has remained unrecognized in large parts of the left, not all, obviously. And so I think it was really one of the things that emerged out of this non-recognition, and I'll talk a little bit about why I think it was misrecognized, was the politics of allyship and privilege. And the reason for this, I agree with Sue very much, is the question of building trust. And I think I'll just go one step forward about the question of building trust. I think as a left, we lost the organizations and institutions where trust would be built and would percolate and then spread on to the social body. So these institutions, you know, till the 30s and 40s used to be large communist parties. After that, it would still be unions and left groups and so on in the 60s and 70s. And throughout the 80s and 90s, I think the left lost that organizational space and institutional space where trust would be built and where multiracial groups of working people would actually work together and do not just political and union work together, but also have a social life together. And those were the spaces in which I think trust was built. And once those spaces were lost and those struggles receded, I think the question of trust and the politics of trust receded into desperately into reaching out between people individually, which, as Sue mentioned, was in a way wonderful because it showed the human spirit of trying to reach to your fellow human in their suffering, but also was inadequate in very, very important ways. So this is where I think the international women's strike and social reproduction theory sort of came together in doing, I think, two important things. One was, it tried to challenge both theory and the kind of things we tried to do in IWS or the International Women's Strike, was it tried to challenge the accepted notion that class was essentially about economic struggles. So what, you know, traditionally in unions were called bread and butter struggles. So this was the fundamental idea that both social reproduction theory and the practice of social reproduction theory in the IWS tried to challenge. Because, you know, when we were when I was talking about the loss of the institutional spaces, the unions did not, you know, entirely disappear, as we well know. And in many, many places, unlike America, unions still play a significant role, especially in Europe. But what happened to the unions was they emerged in the neoliberal period in a deracinated form, and their political project was to weather neoliberalism, not to fight it or threaten it. So their struggles were very much limited, I would say, to the wage form alone. And, you know, they were concerned about the contract and they were concerned about insurance, but they were not really understanding that the wage form was really a mediation between the worker and life. And so if you didn't understand how the life of the working class was being shaped, the role that immigration played, the role that racism played, the role that sexism played on the lives of workers, if you didn't acknowledge that or understand that, then your wage struggle will actually suffer, and there will be no bridges of trust built between the lived life of the working class and the working life of the working class. The union was supposed to bridge that gap, and it failed to do so because of their denudation of power, but also denudation of politics. And this is where I think, again, social reproduction theory and IWS intervenes at the moment, not, you know, as significantly as one would like it to. But I want to talk a little bit about what the development has been from March 8th of 2017 and March 8th of 2018, just to go over the kind of difference and the evolution of these struggles. So the first thing to say is that March 8th this year was celebrated and the struggle was instantiated in over 200 countries. So in Spain, women basically shut down the country. It was a general strike, and it was basically a feminist general strike in the sense that women basically said, when we don't work, nothing works. So women just refused to work at home and in the workplace, and the country literally shut down. Nothing moved in Spain. In Italy, women shut down the entire transport system. Okay, so trains did not move, planes did not fly, not a single car moved in the motorways of Italy on March 8th. In Argentina, there were 800,000 women on the streets demanding gender equality and the end to gender violence. And I'm just saying the sort of top things, the top countries that have been in the news, but there were fantastic protests in Kabul in Afghanistan. There were fantastic protests in Delhi. There were protests all over East Asia, from China, Japan, South Korea, everywhere. And, you know, one of the delightful things being part of the international collective of IWS has been in the last sort of 12 hours or so, having your inbox filled with these pictures from the strike as it unfolded globally. In the United States, IWS was, I would say, very successful. We had rallies and marches in most of the major cities of the U.S. However, I would also like to say that this is, it follows, or March 8th this year could not have come at a better time. March, we kicked off the New York rally with a worker comrade from Connecticut, Stamford, Connecticut, who had just unionized the housekeepers at the Hilton. And she was one of the main speakers who launched March 8th in the United States. And it was a fantastic struggle because, as you know, housekeepers are one of in hotels, as Dominique Strauss-Kahn and Nafisata Diallo's case shows, are one of the most vulnerable sections of the working class, and basically most of the work is done by immigrant women and women of color. So the organization of the unionization of Hilton was a very, very significant moment, and we were very lucky to have worked with the comrades at Hilton, and they agreed to come to the launch meeting. And yesterday, actually, they had vibrant pickets, and they have now formed an IWS Connecticut chapter at Stamford. So this was a very significant but very small, I would say, event that kind of launched March 8th in the United States. But before you knew it, there was social reproduction struggles just kicking off everywhere in the United States. So we first had the West Virginia teachers go on strike. And it was, I spent 3 days in West Virginia with no sleep, constantly speaking and interviewing teachers. It was, you know, absolutely without a doubt, three of the most wonderful days of my life. I have never seen a strike develop and political consciousness develop so rapidly in front of my eyes. This was like you're reading something in a Marxist textbook. I mean, it was just fantastic. So I think all the comrades here know what happened, but it is important to remember that, like the rest of the country, the West Virginia teaching force is 75% women. And West Virginia is also the lowest in the pay scale one of the lowest in the pay scale for teachers in the United States. It is also one of the poorest states. So in this context, neoliberalism had the teachers who were women in a dead vice grip that they could not protest because their wage was the sole category with which they were supposed to bring up their family and be responsible as teachers to their students. But I think one of the important things that happened in West Virginia was the state and the Republican legislator, having cut wages and benefits to the bone, finally did one more thing, which was to raise their insurance premiums. And insurance premiums, the striking teachers told me, had gone up 500% in the last 10 years. I mean, it was an astonishing thing. But it was also very important because this attack on insurance premiums was also very embodied in the sense that all teachers had to get Fitbits. And the Fitbits were to record all physical activity by the teachers. And the teachers had to plug in all their body measurements, so how their waist, list their physical conditions, and so on. Now, the interesting thing about the Fitbit was there were to be no tiers in how that information was used to calculate premiums. So the idea was the more active you were, the lesser your premium would be. And the converse of that is that the less active you are, the higher your premium would be. Now, in that equation, a 30-year-old young man was judged in the same way as a 60-year-old teacher with knee replacement surgery. So the level of activity would be judged in the same manner for the 25-year-old man or 30-year-old man along with the 60-plus female teacher. So this was not just humiliating. It was also clear to the teachers, finally, when it just came as a, all puns intended, as a body blow, that what the entire system of the pension scam that the state was imposing on them was going to be. So that's when the teachers basically said, we've had it. Now, two things are very significant about that, the first group of teachers who simply left work and walked to the state capitol and said, we're not going to work till you fix this, were teachers from the southern counties. So we were told Mingo County, Logan County, and Wyoming County, the southern counties were the places where the teachers were most militant. And some of you comrades may know this, that those are the counties which used to be coal country. And that's where all the battles with the coal bosses and their thugs took place. So every single person, and I spoke to a lot of them from these counties, said almost sounded like classical lines. Yes, I'm a miner's daughter. And yes, my father, who is now 80, did come to the picket line with me. I just can't do the southern accent, but it was just some of the most sonorous words I've heard in my life when you heard this sort of historical connection between past struggles and future possibilities. So as you know, the West Virginia teachers won. And now teachers in Arizona, Oklahoma, and the nurses in New Jersey are considering strike action. what is so significant about these strikes? Yes, they are primarily a female workforce, teachers and nurses, but these are also social reproduction struggles. These are not necessarily about the bread and butter issues. These are struggles that encompass the lives of the people who work and the lives of the people who they take care of. It is traditionally considered part of the care industry, as it were, except it's in the public sector. So these are arenas of social reproduction struggles that are kicking off in such a explosive and extraordinary way in the United States right now. I don't know if comrades have read Kim Moody's recent book, but a significant statistic that he quotes that he uses in his book is the vast majority of jobs added in the United States in the neoliberal period, and especially past 2008, has been in the social reproduction sector. Okay, so in other words, in institutions that assist in the regeneration of labor power for capital. So those are the institutions in which the vast majority of jobs have been added. Those are also the institutions in which women play a central role in the workforce, but they play a central role not just as workers, but as, again, those bridges between the life of work and the lived experience of the worker as well as the people they serve. So, for instance, just to give you an example, women in Charleston and all over West Virginia, like in several other places, play a very significant role in the community. It is women who sort of organize, you know, church picnics and do neighborhood activities and so on. So when the women teachers, when the teachers went on strike, majority women, it was these neighborhood groups and church groups that came out first to support them. That's number one. Number two, the women, that the teachers themselves have to, by necessity, be more than teachers. So West Virginia, as one of the poorest states in the country, the vast majority of students who go to public school, the hot breakfast and hot lunch that the students get at the school are two of the major meals that some of the students get in their day. So when you strike, the school closes down, and so the teachers immediately realize that then the students wouldn't have access to food. So they campaigned and they were helped by churches to serve hot meals to students. In many cases, teachers took those hot meals to their students, and the students repaid in kind. So when the teachers stood on freezing picket lines, students came over and served them hot beverages. Students constantly sent messages to the worker, to the teachers in the state house, saying, you know, Mrs. Smith, we stand with you. You're an amazing teacher. And it was, I mean, these were fourth graders, fifth graders, and of course, high schoolers. So this is a very different kind of struggle from, you know, a union contract. And this is why I think social reproduction struggles are so vital in the coming days and years. And I think this is not an exaggeration or a great prediction to say we will see more of them. And this, I think, is for a very important political reason. I think the capital's attack on unions was basically done from the early 80s, right? So capital broke the back of the powerful combative unions in the 80s with the PATCO strike in the US, with the miner strike in the UK, with the textile workers strike in India. These were huge major strikes that was supposed to break the confidence and push back the working class in the workplace. But since then, and this is why, you know, union density is at a historic low in most parts of the world, depending on the country. I mean, in the country that I come from, in India, I mean, this has never been so low in the history of the labor movement in India. And similarly, the country I live in right now, the United States, it's the same. And the unions have responded again, as I said, by these sort of very careful strategies of not challenging the status quo, but just carrying on to survive in their union activities. So against this, I think what we are seeing is this capital and capitalist states' constant attack on living conditions, which is the cutting of benefits, the cutting of care work, the cutting of public schools and public education, attacks on public health service, and so on. And in those arenas, if those particular workplaces are not, you know, strongly organized, then the resistance will have to come from the community. And if it comes from the workplace, I think through, you know, whatever modicum of unions we have left, it will have to have take the form, the union would have to take the form of a wider anti-systemic battle, because otherwise the question of trust and building of trust would be impossible to achieve, because a vast majority of the workforce, if it is women and immigrants, and the union will fight for your contract, but is absolutely against abortion, or absolutely has nothing to say on immigration and deportation, then that is not a union that the workforce will trust, even in the workplace. So this, I think, is the political landscape in which we are seeing the development of a new socialist feminism, and what we like to call feminism of the 99% or class struggle feminism. And I think in terms of the step forward, I don't think right now we are going to see a vast rise in sort of the older sort of socialist models of recruitment by ones and twos into small, very, very cater-based organizations. What we are going to see is what I would like to call intermediate spaces of organizing. So I think we're going to see a tremendous increase in mobilization in groups like Black Lives Matter, in feminist groups, in the International Women's Strike as an organization, because these are organizations that carry within them the historical memory of oppression. But unlike other groups, I think, unlike other left groups at the moment, they actually, because of their position in social oppression in society, they are actually extremely combative against the system, much more combative than unions and small left groups can be in the current period. So I think as these struggles develop, we're going to see more of these intermediate spaces of organizing. And I think our job as socialists is to absolutely be in these spaces, work with these comrades, and try to rebuild a language of political trust on the basis of solidarity and on the basis of anti-systemic struggles. And this is why I think some of us argued very hard in the international collective of the Women's Strike that as to what our slogan ought to be, and we finally came to the conclusion that our slogan that was going to be used across the globe was "Solidarity is our weapon." And I think it is not an accident that that was the slogan that cohered some of the politics of the International Women's Strike. I'm just going to end with a slightly different, on a slightly different note about social reproduction theory, that it is not just about the lived experience. It is not just about, you know, fighting for food, as in West Virginia, clean water, as in Detroit, or the environment, as in Standing Rock. Unless we have a robust social provisioning system, the workplace is also an extremely dangerous and an extremely unhealthy workplace where the power of the boss is a complete dictatorship over the lives of women. So not only is the lack of unions going to endanger women, but if there was, there are no healthcare provisions, if there is no proper unemployment benefits, then the woman in the workplace is going to have to put up to a certain extent with a rapist boss, with a predatory boss. I mean, that's the reason I think in IWS we were very clear to say that the silence that many of us as women endure in the workplace is not a silence that is generated by fear and embarrassment. It is a silence that is enforced upon us by capital. Okay, it is because we lack the means to fight back collectively that the boss has so much power, it is because we don't know what would happen if we left this job. How would we feed our families? There is no healthcare. There is no public education system. There is no unemployment benefits to take me and my family to the next predatory boss. That period is completely fallow. How would I survive? So those are the considerations that women usually have when they don't speak up against their boss, and that silence is an enforced silence by capital and its institutions, and we have to remember that. So I think one of the things where the Me Too movement and social reproduction theory and the new socialist feminists come together is I think we are all trying to figure out in practice and in theory how to fight collectively against individual harms. That's the first one, that the individual harm exists, but how do you resist it collectively? And the second one is to talk about how to theorize the question of particular harms to universe as a means to figure out the path to universal solutions. So we all know about particular harms, but how does it relate? How do these particular harms of racism, sexism, homophobia, ableism relate to a universal project of emancipation? So those are the two things I think all of these movements and all of us together are trying to figure out. But I am extremely hopeful for the future because I think the figuring out will happen in small meetings like these, in books and in leaflets. But I think it is also beginning to happen at the picket lines and on the streets. Thank you.